Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a unanimous decision today, the Supreme Court ruled that a human gene cannot be patented. The decision, written by Justice Clarence Thomas, calls genes a product of nature. It's one of the most significant rulings in genetic science in the genetic science industry. The case involved Utah-based Myriad Genetics, which held a patent related to two genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, the genes which can indicate a higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. They're the same genes that actress Angelina Jolie has, and you'll remember that earlier this year she announced that she had a preventive double mastectomy in order to reduce her chance of breast cancer. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from one of the plaintiffs in the case as well as a lawyer from Myriad Genetics. But first, we turn to Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate, who joins us from the studios at Yale University. Emily, explain this ruling to us. What exactly was the reasoning behind the court saying that genes cannot be patented?
You know, this is a beautifully simple opinion. It was such a pleasure to read. And it's very common sense. Basically, if you find something in nature and you don't do anything to it other than discover it, you don't get to own it. You can't have a patent of it. In other words, there's no active invention in the pure discovery because you're not changing the gene in any way, and that's not enough for a patent.
Okay, well, so the question now, though, is what is natural versus what is artificial? Because the biotech industry is very, very sophisticated. You know, you make one or two minor changes in a gene, is that then suddenly artificial?
Well, the court said that you can patent synthetic DNA. In other words, DNA that's been altered in some way. And Justice Thomas, who wrote the opinion for a unanimous court, really took pains, I think, to reassure the biotech industry that if it goes in and alters things or applies new knowledge or in some other way really offers up an invention as well as simply the act of picking something out of nature, all of those things could still be patentable.
Okay, so in that case, do you think that does this sort of establish the precedent that's going to inform every other potential case about genetic patenting going forward? Or is there enough wiggle room that we might see future cases make their way up the judicial system?
Oh, I'm sure future cases will come. There are 3,000 patents, I think, of naturally discoverable material out there. And so the first tasks for the lower courts will be to figure out, okay, are those patents just like or enough like Myriad Genetics' patent that they're not allowed anymore? Or is there something else, some active invention going on in them that makes them different? That will be the next kind of road that the courts will take and that will have big implications for the biotech industry.
Okay, so you said that you reminded us that this decision was written by Justice Clarence Thomas. It's a unanimous one, 9-0. We don't see that very often. So what's the significance of the fact that all the justices ruled the same way?
You know, Meghna, we do actually see a strong minority of unanimous decisions. They're just not usually about the cases anyone pays attention to because they're not controversial. I think this one was unanimous because it's such a common sense ruling. There's just something really strange about the breadth of the patent that Myriad Genetics was asserting here. The idea that you can pluck something out of nature, something that's in all of our DNA, and say that one company owns it, and then that only one company can perform the tests for breast cancer and ovarian cancer that are associated with these genes.
Well, Emily, stand by with us for a moment because I'd like to turn to one of the plaintiffs in the case, Lizbeth Siriani. She joins us in the studio. And Lizbeth, the Supreme Court, as we just heard, handed you a victory. What's your reaction?
I'm so relieved. I'm so relieved that after, you know, such a long process that the final decision has been the right decision and our genes are no longer being held hostage by a private company.
You got involved in this case after you were diagnosed with breast cancer 5 years ago.
Yes.
And you needed to find out if you had the breast cancer gene because you wanted to know if you were at increased risk of ovarian cancer as well because the gene is an indicator of that.
Exactly. My oncologist suggested the type of breast cancer I had was indicative of a genetic mutation, and I didn't know of any family history at the time, and she suggested that I get a BRCA analysis to check for a mutation. I immediately went to a genetic counselor to access the test and was told initially incorrectly my insurance wouldn't cover it, and upon further investigation found my insurance would cover it if the lab was a contract provider with my insurance. went back to the genetic counselor, they said, yes, but Myriad's choosing not to contract with your insurance. So you still can't access the test unless you want to pay for it out of your pocket.
And could you afford to do that?
For all of the different types of tests involved in getting a comprehensive BRCA1 and 2 analysis, it would have been close to $4,000 to get the BRCA analysis and their BART rearrangement tests, which was not possible at that time after going through a year and a half of going through a year of treatment.
So I understand that eventually you were able to get the test due to a grant?
Yes, okay. I was finally able to access the test due to a grant. 200 test kits had been gifted to Massachusetts for women that kind of fit my criteria with my type of insurance.
And the result of that was that you
turned out
you
I did
have
what they defined as a rare mutation, which must have come through my father's side, actually.
Mm-hmm. And so you had your ovaries removed as a preventative measure.
Yeah, there was no good effective screening tools for ovarian cancer, and the risk was 80%.
Well, Elizabeth, I guess I wonder, I mean, I hear your story, but Myriad, you know, the company that wanted to patent the gene, it basically makes the argument that in the future, they see rulings like this as suppressing the development of more testing because of the lack of patent protection.
That's crazy. They can patent their tests. They were patenting the actual gene so that no other doctor or researcher was allowed to look at my gene out of my body except for the folks at Myriad. Now they can go on to develop all sorts of different tests to test the same gene and find out different therapies using that gene that they were not allowed to do for the past decade while the patents were in place.
Well, Lizbeth Siriani is one of the plaintiffs in the case that the Supreme Court decided today about patenting human genes. Lizbeth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to the other side of this case. Greg Castañas is a partner at Jones Day and was part of the Myriad legal team. Greg, first of all, can you just respond to what Lizbeth just said, that, you know, regardless of this ruling, Myriad can still make money off its patents that for the tests that it develops? And so why do you need a patent for the genes? You've still got the tests.
Well, let's start. First of all, good afternoon, and let's start by saying that we actually agree a lot with what Ms. Siriani just told you. Myriad does have, in fact, patents on a number of the diagnostic tests, and those were either upheld or not at stake in the Supreme Court's ruling today. What I think it's important to understand about what the Supreme Court ruled today is it ruled that only five patent claims out of well over 500 patent claims that Myriad has directed to the BRCA analysis test that it offers were struck down by the Supreme Court as being so-called products of nature. Four other claims that Ms. Siriani's lawyers had challenged, which were directed to what's called complementary DNA, which is DNA that has been created in the laboratory and has what are called the introns removed, are eligible for patenting.
Okay.
So even those patent claims survive.
I take your point on that, but let's just drive to the fundamental question here, as Justice Thomas wrote in today's decision, that genes that occur in nature, that were created by nature and not by a lab, not by a biotech company, those genes that were merely sequenced by a biotech company, why on earth should a corporation or a company have any patent protection over that?
Well, obviously, we're disappointed in that aspect of the ruling, but at the same time, we also think that what the court did in making that ruling was to not appreciate either the inventive process or the contribution that Myriad's inventors made to society. And I think the notion is somehow or another that these claims to isolated DNA are somehow or another claiming DNA that is in our body. And that's certainly the way Justice Thomas's opinion looked at it. In truth, though, these molecules were actually created in the lab just like the cDNA. And in fact, the patent-eligible cDNA was the starting point for creating those molecules. And once they were created in the laboratory, then it was found that they match up to a certain aspect of the genome in a patient who does not have mutations. And that is exactly what allows them to be used as these diagnostic tools.
Right.
That said, as I mentioned earlier, the today's decision is ultimately, I think, one that I think Ms. Siriani can take great great pleasure in the invalidating of five of Myriad's patent claims, but I think the both Myriad specifically and the biotechnology industry in general breathes a huge sigh of relief because not only did the court recognize that even the claims that were invalidated represented a breakthrough, that's quoting the Supreme Court's decision, not only was it a breakthrough, but that also that all of these other things, like Ms. Sirianni mentioned,
right.
These methods, these diagnostic tests, will still be eligible for patenting and still be the subject of inventions that can be protected by the patent laws.
Well, Greg Castagnas, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop our conversation there, but Greg Castagnas is partner at Jones Day and was part of the Myriad legal team. Thank you so much for your time. Let's turn back now to Emily Bazelon at Slate. And Emily, react to what you just heard Greg Castagnas say there, that, you know, even though Myriad essentially lost this case, they're still seeing it as a victory for the biotech industry.
To me, it sounded like spin in terms of Myriad's own role here. You know, from talking to scientists and also from women who have worried about these tests, my sense is that Myriad really aggressively enforced this patent. Other entities were offering tests, trying to do research. There was some research that happened, but anyone who offered the test got a letter. You know, threatening a lawsuit. And when you aggressively enforce a patent in an area in which there's ongoing research, in which scientists are really trying to do their best to make discoveries that are going to further gains in women's health, and especially when you do that in a way where your own constituency that you're selling the test to and giving it to gets really angry, because that's what happened with the women's health groups, that's going to get you into trouble. And I think that's what we see in this litigation, as well as the Supreme Court drawing this very sensible line between patenting DNA that has been altered and changed and invented in some way, and DNA that simply occurs in nature.
Well, Emily, we've just got a couple seconds to go here, but there are a lot of people out there in the world of science and research and in the biotech industry who do wonder, who will look at this and say, does the court give us enough room to continue to do our research such that we can, in the future, profit from it? Do you think the court allowed that? You know, didn't have a chilling effect as some people had worried that it might?
I think the opinion is written in a very careful way to avoid that chilling effect. It ends with Justice Thomas carefully limiting it and saying, look, if you're applying new knowledge to naturally occurring DNA, if you're using it in a new way, yes, you can still patent that. And so I think the biotech industry probably will breathe a sigh of relief, but this is also a real rebuke to Myriad Genetics and its aggressive enforcement.
Well, Emily Bazelon is legal affairs editor for Slate. Emily, thank you so much as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, this is a big decision about the world of genes and biotech. Let us know what you think at hereandnow.org. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. Well, sorry to say, but there's more not-so-good news on the climate change front. A new report out from the International Energy Agency finds that after a brief dip during the recession of 2008, worldwide carbon emissions are climbing sharply again to a record high level just last year. That report comes on the heels of an announcement last month that a testing station in Hawaii had recorded CO2 levels at 400 parts per million, a major benchmark and the first time it had ever seen levels that high. Stephen Mufson is the energy correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Magda.
So first of all, let's start off with the big picture here. You quote the IEA chief economist, Fatih Birol, as saying that this report gives us a window into an outcome for the globe that could be a disaster for all countries. Now, why is Fatih Birol saying that?
Well, he's saying that because the global emissions of carbon dioxide, one of the principal gases contributing to climate change, is on a track to take us to really disastrous climate change. International climatologists have suggested we try to keep global climate change to an increase of just 2 degrees Celsius. And Fatih's saying that that won't be possible unless we make some changes soon in the way we generate energy. And energy does account for about 2/3 of the world's annual greenhouse gas emissions.
Hmm. And as you're reporting, this report finds that global CO2 emissions rose almost 1.5% in 2012. So let's drill down to what particular emissions were in a couple major countries. First of all, how did the United States fare in 2012?
Well, the United States fared relatively well. Our CO2 emissions in 2012 dropped 3.8%. This is the fourth of 5 years in which U.S. CO2 emissions have declined. And we're back down to levels we haven't seen since the 1990s. That still is modest compared to the scope of climate change, but it's pretty impressive performance for a large economy like this.
What's been driving this year-to-year decrease in emissions? Are there particular environmental or economic factors, or is it also the effect of shifting policy on carbon emissions?
Well, there's some good news on that front. One piece of good news is that the automobile fleet is becoming more and more efficient in line with the government's tightening CAFE standards. And that's one contributor. Another contributor is the substitution of natural gas for coal at a lot of power plants. But some of these things won't keep happening. We won't keep substituting natural gas for coal at this rate. And another thing that's been helping lower our emissions has been the mild winter last year, and relatively weak economic performance if you're looking at our trend lines over the past 5 years.
Right. So let's flip to another side of this story, and that has to do with China. How did they fare?
China's emissions rose 3.8%. In some ways, it was good news because that rate is much lower than China's economic growth rate, but it still remains the largest contributor of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere with about a quarter of global emissions.
So help us take a step back here. I'm wondering what one of the takeaways is from the IEA's report. Do the economists and analysts at the IEA feel that policy isn't keeping up with the global need to control carbon emissions?
They think that we aren't keeping up. And I think it's important to keep in mind just how enormous the scope of this problem is. The IEA points out that by 2017 or at the latest 2020, we'll have all the energy producing plants in place that we could possibly have in order to keep the climate change to that 2 degrees centigrade target. Think about it this way. The population of the world is growing maybe 1% a year. So by 2050, the target date for a lot of these goals, the world may have a third more people. So just to keep emissions steady is going to be a huge task. To actually lower them by 30, 40, 50%, the way a lot of climate scientists say is necessary, is just a monumental task. And frankly, I'm not sure how we get there.
You've reported that the IEA does have some suggestions on how we can at least level off the growth in carbon emissions. What have they suggested?
Yeah, well, they've taken a crack at this, and they're suggesting these measures because they think that they're doable and they won't hurt the global economy too much. So they include energy efficiency measures, and there are a lot of energy efficiency measures that pay for themselves in a very short period of time. They're saying that oil and gas companies need to do more to capture methane at the point of production. That's an important point because methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and a fair amount of it slips out at the wellhead of oil and gas operations.
I guess my last question for you is you've been following, you're the energy correspondent at The Post, and you've been following this for a long period of time. I see this list of suggestions from the IEA, and they're laudable, but none of them really feel groundbreaking to me. So it doesn't seem as if we've made a terrible amount of progress in terms of getting that low-hanging fruit when it comes to controlling carbon emissions.
Yeah, well, that's part of the thing about energy efficiency and things like CAFE standards. They're not too sexy. I've got to say, trying to write about them as a reporter can be incredibly boring. To write about things like caulking windows or changing the way you build a building, I mean, these are not dynamic stories, but they're actually important. So I think that they should be taken seriously. And I think that there will be a push in this term of President Obama's to do more in this area. People often say that he doesn't have any sort of energy policy, but in some ways, the agreement to raise fuel efficiency standards for automobiles, which was done in the first couple of months of his administration, is one of the most important pieces of energy policy you could possibly undertake. So people who are concerned about the specter of climate change, they believe that now is the time for the president to step forward and do something comparable.
Well, Stephen Mufsin is the energy correspondent for The Washington Post. Steve, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, have you ever ignored your doctor's advice? And what would it take to change your mind? How about a brush with death? We'll hear from a Michigan man about why he now listens to everything his doctor says. And still ahead today, for Father's Day, the story of a son and what he discovered about the truth in his father's experiences in World War II. The news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The ICA with Barry McGee. Vibrant paintings and installations capture the energy of the street in this 20-year retrospective on view now. ICABoston.org. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. Summer.harvard.edu.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're following some troubling developments now in the story of last week's building collapse in Philadelphia. Officials say the building's lead inspector, 52-year-old Ronald Wagenhofer, was found dead in his pickup truck last night, an apparent suicide. This comes a week after the Center City building collapsed, killing 6 and injuring 13, and amid continued questions about why it happened and what went wrong. Elizabeth Fiedler has been covering this story for WHYY in Philadelphia. And Elizabeth, I understand that the head of the city's Department of Licenses and Inspections, this would be Wagenhofer's boss, spoke today. What did he say about his death?
Yes, this morning the head of the Department of Licenses and Inspections, Commissioner Carlton Williams, talked in a very sober press conference at City Hall. And Williams said, you know, his department was already struggling with the loss of these 6 people who died in the building collapse. And certainly the death of this inspector is very difficult for the department to deal with. Carlton Williams, the commissioner of L&I, along with Deputy Mayor Everett Gillison, both said that the inspector, Mr. Wagenhofer, was, you know, that he did his job, that he did everything that was expected of him. He followed the city code and did nothing wrong.
Mm. But I also understand that Deputy Mayor Gillison said, in the did nothing wrong phrase that he said, but there were also some complaints regarding the project back in May. Was Wagenhofer involved with those complaints in any way?
Yes. So he was, Mr. Wagenhofer was the lead inspector on this case. There was an inspection on May 14th, and we're still, you know, there's, I believe it's 5 investigations going on right now into what happened, into the building collapse, into, you know, all of these various pieces as to who should be held accountable. So, you know, we'll find out more about the June 5th collapse as those investigations, the results of them come out. But, yes, there was a complaint, and one complaint we've been told was made to the city about this site. And, you know, Everett Gillison, the deputy mayor, said that Mr. Wagenhofer did his job as an L&I inspector, which, of course, brings up these questions about, you know, did everyone else follow what they were supposed to do? Who should be held accountable, if anyone?
Right. Well, we should also note that Ronald Wagenhofer leaves behind a wife and son. So just another terrible turn of events in this already just horrible story. But Elizabeth, Mayor Michael Nutter is also getting some criticism. I understand that a banner on the back of a plane was seen over the skies of the U.S. Open golf tournament in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and it read, 6 died and no change, resign now, Nutter. And there's been criticism of Griffin Campbell, the contractor overseeing the demolition. So are there concerns that that the safety protocols, you know, weren't followed, and what impact will this have on Mayor Nutter?
So there are a lot of concerns. Certainly some have questioned the city and the mayor specifically. A lot of other people have, though, questioned, as you mentioned, the contractor, Griffin Campbell. And in fact, the excavator who he had hired, Sean Benchop, is being charged with involuntary manslaughter. He's believed to had marijuana in his system at the time, and a grand jury is investigating everything that happened on June 5th to determine, you know, if they should be pressing further charges against someone else. But yes, you know, Griffin Campbell, whose construction company was charged with the demolition, there have been questions raised about that. His lawyer said that, you know, said the Salvation Army turned down offers to put up protective scaffolding to protect the store. That was Griffin Campbell's lawyer. So we'll see what comes of that. The Salvation Army has declined to comment specifically on that.
Well, we've just got about 30 seconds here left, Elizabeth. Is there a debate going on about whether inspection procedures need to change in Philadelphia?
There is absolutely a huge discussion right now. And last week, Mayor Michael Netter announced some changes. There have been some proposals put on the table about how to change the current city code, how to change the rules, maybe even how to change state law to make sure that these construction sites are safer both for the people who work there and for people who are nearby.
Well, Elizabeth Fielder is a reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. She spoke with us about the suicide, the apparent suicide of the lead inspector who in that Philadelphia building collapse that occurred last week. He committed suicide, or apparently did so, just last night. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Stick with us. When we come back, we'll hear the latest from Istanbul, Turkey. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Let's turn now to Turkey, where Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he's lost patience with what he calls lawbreakers in Istanbul's Gezi Park. He says he's, quote, making his warning for the last time so authorities can deal with, quote, fringe terrorist groups there. Erdogan used similarly unflinching language after the EU passed a non-binding resolution expressing concern about the Turkish police's crackdown on protests that have gripped Istanbul for 2 weeks. Who do you think you are by taking such a decision? The Turkish prime minister said. Well, joining us from Istanbul, Turkey, is NPR's Peter Kenyon. And Peter, what's happening in and around Gezi Park and Taksim Square right now?
Well, as we see on most days, it starts extraordinarily quietly in the morning. I was there mid-morning, and it was almost normal. People shopping, coffee shops right adjacent to Taksim Square were open and serving for the most part. Not quite normal, of course, because there were quite a few buses parked at every corner filled with sleeping riot police. And there's also wrecked cars still and some barricades around Gezi Park. Crowds are starting to get larger now, as happens as people get off of work. They're coming and making their presence felt. At the moment, I'd say it's less tense even than yesterday, but we have been getting conflicting messages. The Prime Minister Erdogan issued a final warning, as he called it, that people should get out of Gezi Park because they couldn't tolerate it anymore. Their patience was running out. But then, a few hours after that, Istanbul's governor announced that there would be no intervention for 24 hours. So there's really no guarantees, and the protesters are a bit confused. But I'd say, based on what happened yesterday when the governor issued a similar announcement, I'd say the protesters are probably going to stay there another night.
Huh. Well, we've also got news today that one protester who had been hit in the head with a tear gas canister was taken off life support today and pronounced dead. I see that Erdogan supporters are planning counter demonstrations as well. So, I mean, is your sense that this is going to continue on for some time, regardless of what happens with any potential government or law enforcement intervention over the course of the day?
Well, the question of whether the riot police move in again is the wild card that no one can predict with any certainty, at least I can't. The other issue is the continuing political back and forth, and the EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, has criticized the ruling party's plans to hold very large pro-government rallies, first in Ankara and then in Istanbul in the next couple of days. She says that could be even more polarizing for an already divided society, but Mr. Erdogan is not having any of it. He says the EU has no business commenting on Turkey. We mind our own business. And so that's where it stands now. If these rallies do go ahead, it could well exacerbate things and could confuse things, because the protesters have been very clear in standing against the government, And the more that that picture gets muddied, the more things become uncertain.
Now, Peter, this question about the EU is very interesting because for some time now, you know, Turkey has wanted membership into the EU. The EU also recently passed a non-binding resolution expressing concern about the Turkish police and its crackdown on protesters. What's your sense of the current conflict's impact on Turkey's relationship with the European Union?
Well, it's probably strained them a bit, although I think we have to admit that those ties have become less important in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly, maybe the last 5 years. We remember that Prime Minister Erdogan and the AK Party came in 2002 on a wave of European-style reforms. That's really what cemented their popularity with the majority of Turks, that and their handling of the economy. And then, as the EU shied away from moving Turkey through the accession process, the ardor cooled, and so did the reforms. There's been more and more of a move to assert at least Mr. Erdogan and some of his top leaders' natural conservative agenda.
Now, Peter, I understand that members of Erdogan's Justice and Development Party have proposed a referendum on the development plan that initially sparked these protests. And that plan, of course, included plans to cut down trees in Gezi Park and build a replica Ottoman Empire military barracks there and a shopping mall. Do you think that a referendum is likely at all?
Well, that is actually very unclear at the moment. It would, first of all, require a vote by the ruling party's executive committee. It's not clear that that would happen. And I have to say, in terms of Istanbul's rapid development, this is small fry. There are many mega projects on the table, planning, development, and construction stages, and there's going to be quite a few more if Turkey gets to host the 2020 Olympics. As for this referendum on this particular project, I'm somewhat doubtful it would go through, and there's a court case pending in the project right now.
Now, Peter, a lot of the world's attention has been focused on what's happening in Istanbul, but you've also been reporting from the Turkish border with Syria, where I've heard you say that there's opposition to Erdogan for different reasons. So what's happening there?
Well, it's actually very interesting. I was down in Antakya in Hatay province. There's a large Alawite population there, the same minority that Bashar al-Assad is from and the Syrian leadership. There's growing unhappiness, marches and protests every night against the government. Some of the same slogans, unhappiness with Erdogan's rather dominating style. There's a lot of concern down there that the government's policies supporting Syrian rebels very freely, including some Salafist and hardline Sunni fighters, is exacerbating tensions between the Sunni Muslim and the Alawite population down there. And there are growing fears that the sectarian enmity could turn into violence.
And finally, Peter, I mean, I guess the big, possibly unanswerable question at the moment is what impact all these protests and the government response are going to have on Turkey's democracy?
Well, it's a very interesting point, and it is something that will only be known further down the road. But it is possible, if people can take a step back, that this could be an opportunity, as one columnist put it today, to move from a majoritarian society to a truly pluralist society, which is a fairly common plateau among governments that reach a certain level, but then decide if they get 51% of the vote, then the other 49 can just go away. How to move beyond that is a tricky question that each country has to answer for itself. But this kind of crisis, one of the positive things to come out of it, might be a time to debate that and air that view.
NPR's Peter Kenyon there, reporting from Istanbul, Turkey. Peter, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And before we take a break, we've just got to mention last night's nail-biting finish in Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals.
More banging in the boards, and it's squibbed on back to Roosevelt. Roosevelt, a shot!
Well, the Chicago Blackhawks' Andrew Shaw fired in the game winner in triple overtime, putting Chicago up 1-0 against the Boston Bruins in one of the longest games in the history of the Stanley Cup. Game 2 is on Saturday in Chicago. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Like many World War II veterans, Steve Maharaj didn't really talk about his war experiences. He was a Marine, he served in the Pacific, and fought in the very bloody battles on Guam and Okinawa near the end of the war in 1945. He came home, got married to his wife Joan, and started a family. But Steve was an angry and damaged man. His son Dale grew up believing that his father's rage stemmed from those war experiences, but he didn't know why. The only clue was a photo his father always kept near him, a photo that showed his dad and another young Marine named Herman Mulligan. Dale decided to find out what happened to Mulligan and also to his father. The result is his new book, Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. He joins us from NPR in New York. Dale, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here.
Dale, you've said that your dad was the best man and the worst man in the world, and that the needle could go in either way in the same day. So tell us more about him. Tell us more about that.
My father could blow up with these raging fits. We could be at the dinner table. One of his kids would spill a glass of water, and he would just flip. And at a very early age, I connected it with the war. There was a picture in our basement, him and a man on Guadalcanal. I was in the basement with him one day, and he starts shouting to me. He's telling me the story about who the guy was. They blame me, but I didn't kill him. It wasn't my fault. And then he never talked about that picture ever again. That picture haunted me through my entire youth.
So obviously, as you said, your father never talked about that picture again, but you never forgot it. So tell us about what you did later on, what you discovered about the photograph.
He died in 2000, and I decided I have to learn about his war. And I began a 12-year quest to find as many men from his company and talk and learn and find out what happened. Ultimately, I found 29 men, and the quest became bigger than the picture. I learned in my quest that my father had two major blast concussion injuries. As we know more today, it's affecting the soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. It affects football players. Traumatic brain injury is extremely debilitating. My father's behavior, his screaming, his craziness, is one symptom of TBI. And I started meeting these guys. I started meeting their kids. And I learned that our house was not abnormal,
yeah.
That there were many, many troubled families out there. World War II never ended for a lot of these guys and their families by extension.
Was there any one of the men that you spoke to that stood out in particular, any one of the Marines in your father's company?
There was a man, Joseph P. Rossblock. I called Mr. Rossblock, and I said, is this Mr. Rossblock who was on Okinawa? And he says, what do you want him for? Very, very angry, very mean. And I blurted what I was doing, trying to find out about my father's war and this man in the picture. And he, very tenuous conversation, and we left it where we were going to talk 2 weeks later. When I called back, he talked for an hour like a motor mouth, and at the end he said, you're the first person I've ever talked to about the war.
Huh. What's one of the things he told you?
Well, it turns out he carried the body of the man in the picture. What happened was Mr. Mulligan had thrown a grenade into a burial tomb on Okinawa, and it had concealed an estimated 2,000 pounds of Japanese munitions, and it went up like a volcano. And Mr. Rossblock watched a 3-foot piece of the room come down on Mulligan. My father was no more than two dozen feet away from Mr. Rossblock. He had the same blast concussion that Joe had. And so, very painfully, I began to understand my father and why he was the way he was.
Mm. So you mentioned the name of the man in the picture, Mr. Mulligan. Tell us just a little bit about him.
He still remains rather an enigma. I never was able to find his family members, but I learned from the guys in the company that he was half Irish and half Jewish. He came from South Carolina. He was poor. The family was textile mill workers. His mother had died in 1940. He had a great sense of humor. Guys liked him. They remembered him. But they didn't really remember what happened to his body. His body vanished. And to this day, he's registered as an unknown.
Right.
What I think happened, my father, when he said they blame me, my father was squad leader, and he may have ordered Mulligan to throw the grenade into the tomb. And I also learned from the guys in the company that Mulligan was a hemophiliac. He didn't have a chance.
Dale, your journey eventually took you to Okinawa. You mentioned the tomb. You find the place where Herman Mulligan was killed. But something happened right there, right before you came home. Can you tell us what happened?
every night I was on Okinawa for 2 weeks, I would go to the tomb where the had blown up, and there was still half of it was a blown up site grown in with jungle, and there was a new tomb next to it. And on the last night, just before I came back to the States, there was a man there, and I had witnessed another Japanese soldier praying at the death site of one of his buddies, burning incense and having kind of a little ceremony. And I decided maybe I would need to do a ceremony. I'm not going to find Mr. Mulligan. I'd taken my incense. And this man, Junichi, said, he spoke a little English. He said, I will pray with you. Turns out his family had the tomb next door. And it was a very magical moment because at the very end, I thanked him for helping me do the ceremony. And he said, no, thank you. And he had said, no more war. And I went to shake his hand and he hugged me. And no more war. No more war. We don't have closure in life, but that was a moment of. But at that point, I really had understood my father. I felt my journey had ended.
You know, that moment also brings together the threads of suffering across continents that the Battle of Okinawa left. I mean, 12,000 American soldiers died, 100,000 Japanese soldiers, 150,000 civilians. And just that fact in itself and the journey that you took to discover more about your father, makes me think about how many untold stories and experiences every war leaves behind. So for people who have read your book, who have connections to the soldiers who fought in World War II, you must be touching a very sensitive nerve there. What kind of response have you gotten?
Overwhelming. Every day, on average, one or two emails or Facebook posts, handwritten letters from sons and daughters of World War II soldiers saying, we had the same father. I had an email early in the week from a woman who told me her dad killed himself in 1961. He had screaming nightmares and he couldn't take it anymore. A few days later, a woman emailed me. She found out after he died, he was afraid he was going to hurt his family because of his raging fits. He had a lobotomy. I'm hearing from today's soldiers. It's overwhelming how this is touching a nerve.
You know, I think about relationships with parents and with fathers in particular. And so many people, in a sense, don't get the opportunity that you got in terms of trying to discover who this person truly was. And I hear in your voice and what you're describing that you reached a new understanding about your father. So at end of all this, where does this leave you?
My fondest hope is that there's a child out there who has a parent, a mother or a father, who probably will have trauma. There's many of them out there with traumatic brain injury from Iraq or Afghanistan. And they'll read my book someday and they'll understand their parent a little better, be a little more understanding. If I'd have had this knowledge, I'd like to think that I would have been more understanding with my father.
Well, Dale Maharidge's new book is Bringing Mulligan Home, The Other Side of the Good War. We've got an excerpt and some photographs, including that one key photograph that led to Dale's journey. It's all at hereandnow.org. Dale, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
I appreciate it, Magda. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.